Oh, you're quite welcome.
Brilliant. So, basically, I just kind of want to ask you about the work that you did with the with Dr. Persinger, and kind of why you've continued to, I see with your, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, sorry, the Shakti research? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So first I wanted to ask you about how you became involved with Dr. Persinger and his research.
Okay. Well, I'm recording this, and this is going to be edited into a podcast that people will download from my website. So
okay.
Why don't you start off by introducing yourself?
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Hagerty, and I'm a student at Ryerson University.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's pretty much all my information.
Okay.
I'm a journalism student there.
All right. Well, let's try that again from the top. You're Elizabeth Hagerty. You're a student in journalism at thus and such university in such and such a place. Can we try it that
okay.
way?
Okay. Sure.
Go.
I'm Elizabeth Hagerty, and I'm a journalism student at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada.
Well, Elizabeth, nice to talk to you today.
You too.
So you have some questions for me?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to know how you became involved with Dr. Persinger and his university at the his research at the University of the Laurentians.
Well, it began in 1995 when I saw Dr. Persinger on a Discovery Channel documentary. Now,
okay.
when I was a child, I had temporal lobe epilepsy, and one
okay.
of the experiences that I had was of being in an infinite black space with a tiny point of light, you know, unimaginably far away.
Okay.
And the fellow who was in Dr. Persinger's acoustic chamber wearing the Karen helmet and receiving magnetic stimulation
mm-hmm.
Mentioned that he... I'm sorry, can you hold on a second?
Yeah, no problem.
And on this Discovery Channel documentary, with the guy sitting in the acoustic chamber wearing the Karen helmet and receiving magnetic stimulation, was reporting in front of the camera that he was in the middle of an infinite black space with a tiny point of very brilliant light in front of him.
Okay.
And of course, I recognized that experience as one that I had had and also read about in a couple of books on near-death experiences. And I knew that if this was an experiment that could have a result like that, that it was going to have a theory behind it. And whatever
okay.
that theory was, whatever the body of research was, I knew that that was something I wanted to be involved in.
Okay.
So I eventually found out Dr. Persinger's name, which I wasn't able to find out while watching that documentary,
mm-hmm.
and then went to the UCSF Medical Center Library and was able to get a good number of his papers.
Okay.
I had some small credentials as a Buddhist theologian working in the area of reincarnation, and
okay.
I was able to call him up, and on the strength of those rather minor credentials, he was willing to talk to me, and I
okay.
read his papers, called him up, asked him questions, read some more papers, followed up on his references, and basically threw myself headlong into the field, a decision
okay.
I've never regretted.
Mm. And when you were there, did you wear the helmet? Did you test it out?
No, not at Laurentian. I was provided
okay.
with a simple version of the technology, which I used in my own home
mm-hmm.
for quite some time. In fact, eventually I set up a practice in Middletown, California, where people
yep.
would come in and receive the stimulation as my clients. And they
okay.
were primarily motivated by consciousness exploration, sort of a desire to live to their potential more, to see what they were capable of. And in most cases, I was able to do something for them that they appreciated and felt was beneficial for them.
Okay.
In,
and what sort of experiences did they have when in your clinic when they came in?
Well, it wasn't a clinic, I need to be clear.
Okay.
I'm a researcher, not a clinician.
Mm-hmm.
I don't diagnose, treat, or prevent medical disorders, and that's a matter of FDA regulations.
Okay.
Let's see. We didn't have an acoustic chamber there like Dr. Persinger has, so we weren't able to get as striking results. With this technology, sensory deprivation is very, very important. A large part of the temporal lobe's ongoing activity is devoted to monitoring ambient sound.
Okay.
And as long as you have a soundscape, you're not going to be able to recruit all of the temporal lobes into the stimulation experience. We did have some interesting results. We had some people who had minor visual imagery. We had one guy actually see God.
Really?
Yeah. We had a number of people who actually explored their irritability. That is to say, one session design made them irritable, but it made them irritable in a way that they really liked. Instead of just being annoyed, let's say, when there's no parking space or when their television show isn't on, they were annoyed when they were put down. And every one of them had an urge that they acted out on to stand up for themselves. And I got a lot of positive feedback from that. They really felt that their position in life had improved through the stimulation. We had some visions of aliens, just short, fleeting visions, as well as, what can I recall offhand? An image of a snake appearing out of the background and sort of spiraling its way towards the subject where it disappeared. We weren't really set up for sessions with effects that occurred during the stimulation. The focus then, as it always has been for me, has been on the effects that occur after the stimulation. It's easier to do because you don't need the sensory deprivation. And it's closer to the goal that I have for this technology of it facilitating spiritual growth.
Okay. That's what I want to ask you about. When you first went to see the technology, did you go there thinking that it could be used in a spiritual way? Or was it more just because of the image was like when you had the epilepsy? Did you kind of go there with that goal in mind, or did it come to you later that this was more of a spiritual experience?
My initial emphasis on learning about the technology and getting my very first prototype was on eliciting spiritual experiences.
Okay.
And only after I had begun using it for a while and after Dr. Persinger published some papers that dealt with the after effects did I realize that this was something that could be used for spiritual growth. And like many Zen Buddhist teachers, I now tend to de-emphasize the experiences that happen during the stimulation itself and encourage people to focus on what happens after the sessions. And for certain kinds of effects, this technology can elicit some very dramatic effects after the sessions. We've never had an out-of-body experience with Shakti during a stimulation session. However, there have been out-of-body experiences, and the way they occur is that the person does the stimulation, then they wait a bit, then they go to bed, and in the twilight state, they will have out-of-body experiences.
Okay. Why do you think it's after they've used the technology that they have these experiences? Is their mind changed in some way, or they have a different way of interpreting what's around them? Why?
No, it's more a matter of the after effects of the session, literally in the brain's electrical firing.
Okay.
After discharges, after we put in a magnetic signal with a certain shape or pattern, for a while after the session, the brain continues to produce that signal on its own. Because these signals are largely derived from the brain's own natural, organic firing patterns anyway, they're familiar to the brain, so the brain is already set up and able to produce these signals on its own. So the signals appear for a while after the session, and probably for several days, based on some of the reports I've had from Shakti users.
Mm-hmm.
And after the session, these after discharges combine with other tasks. And these can include using other mind machines, meditation, or exploring that twilight state, so that you get a twilight state that has more of these signals in it than you ordinarily would. And the brain is able to combine these signals in their natural functioning with the job that it's doing at that moment. And the result can be, with a little bit of added intention on the part of the person, the after effects of the session, combined with the brain's activity that arises from the job it's doing after the session, to create an entirely new effect. People who do meditation and use Shakti often have a difficult time meditating right during the session. But okay, if they do it afterwards, so that the after effects of Shakti can combine with the neural jobs that meditation creates, the effect can be a greatly enhanced meditation, an experience that is more than what they got from the session itself, during the session, mm-hmm. is more than what they get from meditation without the stimulation, and actually creates a serendipitous third class of effects. And needless to say, the people who use Shakti this way are very pleased with their results.
And has this, is your view of spiritualism that it's something internal within the brain? There's kind of no external link? Because it seems that with this technology, you're stimulating your mind and it's electricity within your brain. And so all kind of spiritual experiences are purely internal.
All spiritual experiences are internal. Whether they're purely internal or not is another question. Let's say, for example, that someone is sitting with a Shakti unit on their head. They have excellent sensory deprivation. They're completely blindfolded. Let's say they're doing the session at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they live in the country, so they're actually able to get real silence during that time of night. Mm-hmm. And they see God. Is the God that they're seeing entirely the result of brain stimulation, or are they matching through the stimulation the pattern that would need to appear in order for them to experience God naturally? Let's say there's a God that exists outside of us, and when we're connected to that God to the extent that we're actually having a vision of God, our brains are going to have a certain characteristic firing pattern for that moment.
Okay.
And if a Shakti is able to duplicate that pattern, are we creating an hallucinated vision of God, or are we creating the neural invitation for God to appear?
Okay.
There's no way of taking this, the evidence that comes from this line of research, and extracting from it any decisive proof that God does or does not exist.
Okay.
The classic experience that people use to frame the question that you're alluding to is about out-of-body experiences. When we're out of our bodies, are we really out of our bodies? Or mm-hmm. are we just having an hallucination in which the center of our perception seems to be out of our body and we experience the world from that perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Although there is some evidence that out-of-body experiences are actually veridical, that when you are having an out-of-body experience, you, whatever that means, is actually out of your body.
Okay.
But there's no way of separating whether you're having an hallucination of being out of your body that is through some sort of disinhibition of native psychic skills, able to know what's going on in other locations, and is thus an hallucination, or are you really out of your body? There's no way of separating those two out so carefully that we can prove the one or the other. There's a bit of evidence that suggests that out-of-body experiences are real in the children's sense of being really, really real.
Okay.
But as far as decisive actual proof, sufficient to justify a person giving up their faith in a God that exists outside of them, we don't have that much yet. Personally, as a researcher, I would never, even if I had that proof, I would never want to lay it in front of a person who has a productive and joyful relationship with God as they understand them. If that God were proved to be only an artifact of brain function and we laid that in front of them, would we have improved their lives? I think not.
Yeah. Okay. And Is there a difference in kind of the makeup of the brain of someone who is able to have experiences when they use this technology and someone who it has no effect on at all?
Well, first of all, I don't think that there is any such person as someone that it has no effect on at all.
Okay.
I would say at any given time, less than 2% of the people who have obtained their Shakti unit within the previous year are reporting dud sessions.
Okay.
My best guess is that for this very small number, what is happening is that their brains are indeed responding to the signals, but they are accommodating them. They're adjusting, taking them into account and sort of glossing over the effects.
Okay.
I've seen some cases where people have used this technology without effect, made some changes to the signals, comparable to raising the bass or raising the treble, changing the volume a bit and so forth, changing the sound device that's actually outputting the signals, and then their sessions went from dud to dramatic. The most commonly reported tweak that raises the effectiveness of this technology has been simply raising the volume. The normal level for the volume, and this won't mean anything to you, but the scale will, is 10 milligauss. Now for women, the effective range is a bit lower, around 6.5 milligauss.
Okay.
And there have been men who have had sessions without much effect until they raised their volume up to around 15 milligauss. And in one case, there was a guy who regularly did sessions at 45 milligauss.
Really?
And
wow,
found that they were
different.
Very, very effective. Now, you have to realize that even at 45 milligauss, you're still talking about very low-intensity magnetic fields. If you want to put 45 milligauss of raw magnetic field into your head, take a couple of large screen televisions, put them close together, put your head between them, and then kind of squish them together so they're actually touching your head, and you're up in those ranges. These are not very dramatic field strengths.
Mm-hmm.
There is a technology called RTMS. TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation, and it's used in clinics all over the world these days for the treatment of depression. And there they're using field strengths that are so high we can't even express them in milligauss anymore. They're literally a million times more intense. And they do their work through direct current induction. If you put enough magnetic if you put a strong enough magnetic field into any electrical system, you can actually force that system into operation simply through the intensity of the magnetic field.
Okay.
So that's actually forcing it. And with complex magnetic signal technology, of which Shakti is an example, is used, what we're doing is actually putting in some of the brain's own natural firing patterns to elicit those same firing patterns as a result. And according to whether we do it over both sides or one side, and which signal we're using, we have a lot of latitude as for we have a lot of latitude with respect to choosing the kinds of effects that we can get.
Okay. And if you're kind of altering the brain's firing patterns in these ways, and you don't just do it once, will it change the way that you perceive things on a daily basis?
We've had a number of reports of what's called enhanced visual acuity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an experience where, when it happens spontaneously, people might say that they're seeing the divine in creation or experiencing God in all things. And this tends to happen most readily when we use a signal derived from the hippocampus, which is a very cognitive structure and is involved in spatial perception, as well as memory creation and retrieval. So when you say see things differently, yes, very much so, literally seeing. But I think you mean in a kind of metaphorical way, where we're talking about how people experience the world and experience the people around them. And yes, we've had many reports along that line as well. People find that their tendency to pessimism and self-defeating thought can be reduced. They find that their moods are just simply a little bit better. A lot depends on how they use the technology. It is possible to get a good effect like that and then move on to another session design, which will tend to cancel out the earlier one and bring in something new. But yes, it has had lasting effects that tend to change the way people see the world and experience themselves, and even more importantly, experience being with other people.
Okay.
For me, the highest spiritual good is to be found in simply living an ordinary life and being happy and relating to people without any need to exaggerate, any need for complaint, for put-downs, for, for pessimism. Life can be good if you let it be good.
Okay.
And there have been many reports from Shakti participants that suggest that somehow their use of this technology has allowed them to let life be good.
Okay. I guess what I want to ask you about now is a bit about ghosts, because, as you know, that's what my paper is going to be on. And I was referred by a paranormal research society in Canada to Dr. Persinger's research, because they were saying it was a way to prove the existence of ghosts. And I wanted to know what you thought of that statement, if this technology did prove ghosts and if people experience ghosts through it.
I think that they have overstated things a bit. I don't think it proves that there are ghosts any more than visions of God in the lab prove the existence of God. What this technology does prove is that the experience of seeing a ghost or of sensing one's presence is an absolutely real experience, no more to be dismissed than dreams, which may not be about real things, but dreams themselves are absolutely real. Hell, we've got EEG data to prove it. So I think even more than proving that the experiences are not fabricated, they're not made up, when someone says they've seen a ghost, they're probably talking about a real experience. What it does is it tends to validate the model for how these experiences can occur, at least in their neural component. And the way that works is that you have two senses of self, one on the right side of the brain and one on the left. Now, ordinarily, these work in tandem. They're quite seamlessly integrated together. And so you experience yourself as you, whatever that may mean, moment to moment, day to day, throughout your life. Now, there can be moments when the two sides of the brain, each in their activity supporting the sense of self, can be a bit disturbed or disrupted. They can fall out of phase with one another. And when that happens, the right hemispheric sense of self emerges into the awareness of the left hemispheric sense of self. And because we cannot be two beings at once, don't ask me why that is. I don't think I could really tell you that. But I do know that people with multiple personality disorder are occupied by one of their sub-personalities, one personality at a time. They're not taken over by two or three of them.
Okay.
So there's a corroboration for that there. But the right hemispheric sense of self is projected outside of the self and seen as a ghost. Now, generally speaking, ghosts are a little bit frightening. So that indicates that one particular brain part, the amygdala on the right side, which is specialized for fear, is dominating the experience. Now, if the same thing happens and the amygdala on the left side is dominating the experience, then that experience will be much more positive, joyous, even blissful. And then instead of saying, this is a ghost, they're much more likely to interpret it as an angel and project all the connotations of angelic being onto their projected, externalized, right hemispheric sense of self. Angels, ghosts, God, demons, all appear to be different manifestations of the same process, a process that produces what Dr. Persinger has termed the visitor experience. So it doesn't prove the existence of ghosts. It proves our capacity to experience ghosts regardless of how real they are, and it tends to prove, or rather, tends to support the hypothesis that the experience of ghosts is attributable to an alteration in our normal sense of ourselves.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Those are pretty much all of my questions. I'd just like to ask you some basic bio information, if that's all right.
Yes, please. Go right ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I was wondering, whereabouts are you from exactly in California?
I live in San Francisco.
Okay. And are you from there originally?
No. I was born in Michigan, southeast Michigan.
Okay.
An area that is an area that has frequent UFO reports. And in fact,
really?
My temporal lobe epilepsy began shortly after I saw a strange red light in the sky.
Really?
Yes. And if you get the movie Fire in the Sky, where they where it treats alien and excuse me. If you get the movie Fire in the Sky, which deals with an alien abduction experience, you'll see that it begins with a red light in the sky that was very similar to what I saw.
Okay.
So after that, I lived in Boston and a few other cities, Bangkok, India.
Okay. Wow. Why were you traveling so much?
I wanted to.
Mm.
I wanted to see Hindu culture. You see, I had temporal lobe epilepsy. I'm going to have to start that sentence a third time.
That's right.
You see, I had temporal lobe epilepsy as a child, and to this day, I still have the personality traits that go along with temporal lobe epilepsy. And one of them is a fascination with spirituality, all things spiritual, religious themes, religious art, religious imagery, religious stories, I forget where that was going, but never mind.
But that it kind of led you to travel around because you wanted
yes,
to
experience.
Yes,
that's right.
Experience.
So anyway, this long-standing fascination with spirituality made it possible for me to get a deep and abiding interest in other religious traditions, most importantly Hinduism and Buddhism. I very much like the Buddhist idea that there is no self, which as a neuroscientist I take and spin out into an hypothesis, which actually holds a certain amount of water, so to speak, that the self does not exist. Rather, what we are when we experience ourselves as real is... I'm going to try that sentence another way. What we are... what we are, such that we experience ourselves as real, is actually an ongoing hallucination in a sensory modality, like vision, hearing, taste, touch, and so forth, that only has one object it perceives, and that object is an hallucination, the hallucination of self.
Okay.
And I believe that the self exists so that we have a locus, a place where all of the information coming both from our senses and informing us about the world outside of ourselves, as well as our emotional and cognitive processes, are all combined into a single entity so that we can experience how we are right now. We can experience what we're doing right now in order to be able to change it rapidly when threats to our survival appear.
Okay.
So we don't exist. We are, so to speak, a vision we're having of ourselves through a set of eyes that only sees ourselves.
Okay.
Not to rip off the poets with too much banality, but I only have eyes for me, as do you. And
okay.
I think even when we fall in love, we're projecting some of that... some of our right hemispheric sense of self outside of ourselves, but not onto a blank sheet, so to speak, as we are when we experience a ghost or an angel, but rather projecting it onto another individual.
Okay.
And because of presumably left hemispheric involvement, it's possible for us to love that which we project. I think it's also possible that when we do the same thing with... our right amygdalas, when they're dominating the experience, it can often turn into something like loathing or hatred, which is why it's so easy to get so many people, why it's which is why it's so easy to use propaganda to get so many people involved in hating so many other people that they've never met, never seen, and have no real inkling of. The racist, the white racist who has a visceral response to conversation with a black man is probably projecting some part of himself, and through his childhood training and his intellectual allegiances, inviting that to be dominated by the right amygdala. It's a very powerful concept, the idea that the sense of self can be projected outside of ourselves. It does explain how we can have visions of things like aliens, angels, ghosts, and so forth, but it also explains how people can go so firmly and seemingly irretrievably into the states of hatred that are relied upon, that are necessary for things like war, lynchings, hate crimes, and even terrorism.
Okay. And how did you end up studying neuroscience from this kind of fascination with Buddhism and spirituality?
Well, I knew that there was more to the inner world, if I can call it that. There was more to consciousness than spirituality was addressing. Because when I was a child, I had had temporal lobe epilepsy. I had out-of-body experiences. I had strange sensations in my body. I saw the world expanded to enormous proportions with my eyes open. When they were closed, I had the experience of looking into an infinite void. But when they were open, I would see the room around me expanded enormously, as though I were now in an amphitheater or even something even larger. Then when I began to read about Hinduism and Buddhism, I found no reference to these experiences. I found more telling hints in Alice in Wonderland to account for these experiences than I ever did in the Buddhist scriptures. And like a good Buddhist boy, why, I read them. O Shariputra, thus I have heard. And that sentence never concluded with descriptions of these kinds of experiences. Eventually, later on in life, after I began an interest in neuroscience, I was referred to a very abstruse and reasonably rare Buddhist scripture called the Path of Purification, or the Visuddhimagga of Buddhaghosa Acharya. And there, embedded in it, there was a passing reference to a formless absorption state, an arupa jhana, in which you saw into an infinite black space. And I forget the Sanskrit name for this space. I believe it may have been akasha jhana, akasha meaning space. But it was a space in which, a state of consciousness in which you would experience infinite space. And this some 20 years after the first time I ever opened a Buddhist book. And then I realized that a few meditators were probably onto it. But as I searched for more information about it, nearly everything I found referred back to the same original text. So I knew there that religion didn't have enough. It didn't have enough of the truth that I personally wanted to have. And I told a Buddhist teacher about this. And I said, well, you know, I had these really way out experiences when I was a child. I'd wake up in the middle of the night. Temporal lobe epileptic seizures are much more common at night when melatonin levels are higher. And I'd be in a state of infinity. And the Buddhist teacher would say, this experience is not on the direct road to liberation from all suffering through the Noble Eightfold Path. Therefore, you should forget about it. Well, no, I'm not going to forget about this. These experiences shattered me. They literally drove me insane. And there is a psychosis that tends to go along with temporal lobe epilepsy. But as a child, I had these experiences. And actually, I was being treated to an intensive Catholic upbringing. And there were realms of experience that were alluded to in Catholicism. You could be in heaven, you could be in hell, you could be in purgatory, or you could be in limbo, where the souls of babies waiting to be born hang out. But I knew this experience wasn't any one of them. So when I saw this experience being produced by Dr. Persinger through his experiments, I said, yes, this is it. This is what I want to know about. Okay. And then eventually the technology elicited reports of meditation enhancement, where the technology is used first, and then through that combining of after discharges with neural tasking that we discussed earlier, meditation was enhanced. And then I said, okay, well, this will cover the ground. It's not just about my strange experience. It actually will give us some insight into the power of prayer, whatever that may be. It will give us some insight into transformation of consciousness through meditation, whatever that may be. This technology and the theories that support it actually will cover the entire ground of human spirituality. And then I began to see the possibility that working in that field would allow me to contribute to the preservation of spiritual practice, yoga, meditation, and prayer, in an era when people are moving away from traditional religious belief.
Yeah.
Spiritual practice, prayer, meditation, is a very, very big baby to throw out with the comparatively unimportant bathwater of medieval spiritual ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And just because they're medieval does not mean they're necessarily wrong. They're right when they're taken within their native context. And
okay.
It certainly, absolutely does not mean that these ideas lose any of their beauty. Meanwhile, if you want to get into the hard science of it, you get into rigorous descriptions of neural activity. Where's
mm-hmm.
the beauty in that? Will you open a neuroscience text when you lose your husband?
Yeah.
You know, when he dies? How will you process your grief? Will you open a book on brain science? No, you will put your hands together in front of your face. You will lower your head and you will say, "Dear Lord," and then you will finish that sentence however you will.
Mm-hmm.
But that is... our spiritual traditions, our religious traditions, are intellectual and emotional treasures that must be preserved through the process of the scientific understanding of spirituality and religion.
Okay. And you're currently doing research at the University of San Francisco?
No, I'm working independently in San Francisco.
As
close a collaboration with Dr. Persinger and Stan Koren at Laurentian as I can manage. They're both frightfully busy men, but we do have a few things on our table right now that we're working on. One of them is a new brain stimulation device. One other one is actually a clinical application, which I'd rather not describe here because of FDA regulations and requirements.
Okay.
But and I live in San Francisco because my daughter is here.
Okay.
And I need to be where my daughter is. Another thing about which I will not open a neuroscience text. I love my daughter. I'm projecting my right hemispheric sense of self onto her.
Mm-hmm.
You think that matters when she comes home with a good report card? Of course not. I'm thrilled.
No,
I'm proud. I love this being. I'm proud of what she does. I am the proud father. Imagine the thumbs stuck in the outside of the vest, the cigar in the mouth, the chin up. That's my daughter, guys. It's another occasion for not opening a neuroscience text, even though the experience can be explained using neuroscience.
Yeah, looking through that. Well, those are all of my questions I have for you. Thank you ever so much for talking to me.
By the way, where are you from?
I was born in Vancouver, but I grew up in England.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my excuse for my accent.
Oh, no need for an excuse. It's perfectly lovely accent.
Oh, cheers. Well, yeah, thanks again for talking to me. It's,
and just so you know, while I'm still recording, I want to tell you that this interview is going to be edited, placed on my website, and available for download as a podcast. It may eventually be put on a CD with other interviews and offered for sale, out of which I'm so very sorry to have to tell you this. You will receive nothing. And you waive all copyrights to the audio of this of this interview and to me, and you retain the right to use anything I have said in anything you might write, whether it's for academic or publication purposes. Just don't when you do that, don't quote me out of context. And I will of course edit so as to make you sound brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Okay, well, nice talking to you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.